Session number 8177.
Wing Commander Shannon, Reel 2. Having practiced over the aerodrome with the spotlights, we then moved on to flying over water, and various lakes in the country were selected for this purpose, or reservoirs, more correctly, I suppose they were, one of them being the Derwent Water, the Derwent Reservoir outside Sheffield, which we used, and we found there that one of the problems was getting down to the right height from 150 or 200 feet or wherever we were, and then getting the spotlights right. And this was done by the navigator or the radio operator looking through the blister in the side of the aircraft and saying down, 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 until the two beams converged, making one spot on the water. And we found that actually flying over the water, we could be very much more accurate over still water than we were over the runway. And it was very successful. But it was hellish low, I don't mind saying, there, especially in the first runs that we made with this. One thought that, you know, the chap that was calling out the down, down, down was never going to stop. But once we got the feel of it, of course, it was perfectly all right. And we had to carry out quite a lot of practice with using the spotlights, because it did become absolutely essential that the bombs, when they were released, had to be released at a speed, and the speed had been calculated at 232 miles an hour. So what we did on the airspeed indicator, we made a little red mark against the 232, so that when the needle came around we could see that that was for the pilot, and that was the left of the radio operator, who moved out of his seat at that time and looked through the blister and controlled the height. And then if one wandered off, they would say up a bit or down a bit, up a bit or down a bit. But we found that we could do it quite accurately, very well.
Did you have any dangerous moments during training?
Oh, I think in the early days, not so much dangerous as damage to aircraft. We had a certain amount of trouble with branches from trees occasionally. There's a certain amount of damage, not serious damage done, but also birds were a problem too, that we had quite a few aircraft damage with hitting birds flying at that height. And it's surprising that the damage that a bird will make to an aeroplane. Of course, we were propeller aircraft, and so there was no real danger of damaging the engines or anything like that. They were just mashed up. But a bird would just come through the fuselage or through the wing, just like a bullet, you know, and leave a hole there. So there was a certain amount of that. Not an awful lot, but a certain amount of damage was done like that. But the practice period went on for, I suppose, about 6 weeks. And if memory serves me correct, I think during that period of time, the squadron had carried out something like 2,000 hours flying, which was approximately 100 hours per crew of practice training from formation. That was from the formation of the squadron to the actual takeoff for the raid.
You mentioned the formation flying training. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, the formation flying training was to keep us together, to give us a pattern, really, for any attack that may come from fighters. Bombers of World War II were only equipped with 303 machine guns, and to concentrate firepower, it was more sensible to have aircraft in VIX of 3 to give a stronger firepower than individual aircraft, and to try and keep the aircraft together, because the whole secret of the operation was to be surprise and at this low level and accuracy. And so that was the reason that formation flying was necessary to take place. And so all of the cross countries was done in formations of three aircraft, the leader and the number one and the number two.
Now, you said that you didn't know the object of the raid early on. Was there any speculation about
All sorts of speculation going on. Once we were told to practice flying over water, of course, the first thought was that it would be U-boat pens or something like that that the target would be. We had never, at any moment, I don't think any of the crews ever suspected that the target eventually was going to be the German dams. As I said before, Gibson was the only one that had been let into this secret, and security on the squadron was absolutely fantastic. I mean, all mail out was censored, all telephone calls were listened to, and it was stressed time and time again the necessity for security, and nobody was to talk about what we were doing or what was happening at all. And it wasn't until, I suppose, early in May, end of April, early May, that we started getting the modified Lancasters, which had had the Bombay doors removed and a cutout section fared off underneath the belly of the aircraft with the suspension arms down, to actually carry these very cumbersome mines, which were the eventual bombs which were dropped. And of course, when these arrived on the squadron, each member of the squadron was allocated his aircraft, and the crew looked after them. And of course, we were flying these things around, not knowing what in the hell we were going to pin underneath them for quite a long time, and until I suppose a week, 10 days before the actual raid itself came about, that we actually saw the mines coming in. They all came into the by road transport on low loaders, but covered under tarpaulins, and were taken into the bomb dump, and there was utmost secrecy there, so we never saw them until they were actually brought out and there. But toward the end of the raid, toward the end of the training period, we were each, when the experiments had finally been completed by Barnes and the experimental people from Boscombe Down, we were each given a dummy of these things to drop down again over the sea off Margate at Parkston, I think it was, to try these things out. The other problem there, of course, when we found this out, was that they had to be dropped some way back. It was not like we'd done all the practice bombing in the early days, just dive bombing on a target and releasing by sight and a judgment with practice bombs over Wainfleet. But we were then told that we had to line up on the two main pillars, which are pretty standard, I think, on all dams throughout the world, on either side of the dam, on either side of the dam wall, and release quite some way back from these, so that you've got these two pillars in a V going through, and you released, oh, it was some 40, 50 yards back that we were doing with the practice bombs. Of course, then we had to do that considerably further back when we actually knew what the target was to be with the bouncing bombs, as they turned out to be. The object there was to spin these, a reverse spin on the mine, up to 500 revolutions, being driven by a belt by an electric motor from inside the aircraft fuselage, which created a tremendous vibration in the plane, and just this thing spinning. And then when it was released, it would skip across the water, rather like throwing a stone, a flat stone across the water, skip across the water with the eventual aim of it settling up against the dam wall, and then with a hydrostatic fuse it would roll down the dam wall and explode some 30 feet under the water, and with the weight of the water behind it, Barnes Wallis had calculated that one of these things should shatter these dams. In the event, of course, it took several in each case to break the dams.
When you first saw the mines, what did they look like? What impression did they make on you?
Well, they're rather like a huge oil drum, rather more a bigger diameter than an oil drum, and a most cumbersome looking thing. And of course, they were carried athwart ships, as it were, so that you get the revolve. The revolving of the drum on the axle, which went through the centre of the bomb. There was an axle through the centre of the bomb, and two arms came up, opened out, and then clamped into it. And the release of the thing was to lift these arms away from the bomb, and then it dropped straight down. And of course, it was already revolving, and it had its spin, and then it would skip across the water. It had the speed of the aircraft with its forward momentum and the spin to give it the skip so that it wouldn't bury itself into the water and skip across the water. And there were three or four skips. It was aimed so that the bomb would skip three or four times before it rolled and then came up to the wall, hit the face of the wall, and then would roll down the wall and explode, as I say, under a hydrostatic fuse. Some 30 feet down.
How did the practice at Margate and Parkeston go, far as you were concerned?
The practice, as far as we were concerned, was quite successful. It was really given to us. The bombs that we dropped, of course, were only dummies, and they were filled, I think, with concrete. But they were simulated to the exact weight. I think the weight of the bomb, if memory serves me right, was something between 6,000 and 7,000 pounds, the fully armed bomb, because it had a fairly hefty steel casing on it to stop it breaking, with the problem we'd had if you drop it from too high, the casing would shatter. And to get the feel of the aircraft at low level, A, with this thing spinning, and then the behaviour of the aircraft when you released it. And they were quite successful, those runs. I think they recovered some of them after the war, these practice things up, they rolled up in the mud, but nothing was done about them at the time. They just rolled them off and left them there.
Did any amusing or bizarre incidents occur during training?
I think we had a few bizarre incidents because of the carte blanche we had with low flying. It was great sport on a summer day to fly as low as one could down the canals over Lincolnshire and upset the boats and the people punting and that sort of thing, and see them scuttle for the shore, which with hindsight is probably not as much amusement to them as we thought at the time. But that sort of thing happened occasionally. But it was a very serious time, and we were training seriously for what we knew not at that time, other than we had been told that if it was successful, it could well lead towards shortening of the war. And so everybody, during wartime, were fairly serious about these things, you know, actually on the flying and on the training. It was a very serious business.
How apprehensive were the air crews about the raid before it happened?
Doesn't really talk about apprehension. I think every individual has his own feelings, but I mean, one had joined the forces to defeat the enemy, and apprehension of that form, in the form that we know it perhaps today, didn't really occur. I mean, all of the men that had been picked for this squadron were experienced bomber crews. All of them had completed at least one tour of operations, some of them more. and all of them had volunteered because everybody was given the choice. I mean, it was not it was not an order that one joined this squadron. Gibson and group went out to the crews and said that they would like this, and everybody was given an opportunity to say yea or nay. And in fact, some of the crews in the early days that joined, I think Gibson got rid of as unsatisfactory and posted them elsewhere.
Did anybody leave voluntarily?
Not to my knowledge. Once they joined there was nobody left voluntarily.
Were your feelings before this raid any different from what they would have been before any other raid?
No. I think the feelings before this raid, after the briefing, were one of elation, excitement, and to a certain extent relief that the training that we'd been doing was coming to an end, and here we could see that the actual operation was about to take place and we were to strike a blow against the Hun. I should think it's most of us had a feeling of elation that at last we were going to do something. Because, of course, we had done nothing but practice. We were on an operational station with another bomber squadron who were operating at night there, and nobody knew what we were training for. And there was a certain amount of talk of the 617, the new squadron there, does nothing but practice fly. When are they going to do something? So we were all very keen, obviously, to get on and do it. But again, looking back with hindsight, I mean, the training that took place and the concentration that was required to achieve the accuracy that was required was only a period of 6 weeks. It's not really very long, not really very long, although it seemed an age at that particular time.
You've talked about the tight security, but were there any breaches of security that you knew of?
Nothing serious. There was one chap, I think, if I recall, had phoned through to a girlfriend or something and said that he was going off on a low-level cross-country or something, and he was hauled up in front of the entire squadron by Gibson and said that nothing had come of this. This is the sort of breach of security that he didn't want, and nobody was to talk about what they were doing or anything at all to anybody. And the example made of that poor bloke, I think, stressed the importance of the security, and we heard no more of any breaches of security from anybody. It was absolutely as tight as a drum, security. I think group had also posted in quite a few additional security people who were around and about the aerodrome, obviously doing some other jobs, ostensibly, about whom we knew nothing, but they were there to ensure that there was no breach of security.
Was the chap who breached security named by Gibson then?
Yeah, oh yes, he was named. He was named.
Now, can we go on to the briefing, and can you tell me about that?
Well, the briefing took place in the first instance. It was purely the pilots and the navigators were called forward because they had arrived on the station some time before models of the Mona Dam, the Ada Dam, and the Sorpy Dam, which were the prime targets for attack, and scale models, contour models of these had been made by MOD and sent up to us to the station specifically for the briefing. So earlier the morning of the 16th of May, the navigators and pilots were called up to the squadron briefing room, and these things were unwrapped. They were under covers, were unwrapped, and we were eventually shown what the targets were to be, and we were told to study them, memorize them, and get as much from the on the models as we possibly could. Gibson and the nav officer, together with some of the pilots, with their experience of Germany, had mapped out the routes that we were to fly in. And that was across from Scampton, across the North Sea to the Dutch coast, to some islands just off the Dutch coast, between those two islands, both of which were heavily defended, crossing the Dutch coast down into Germany, and then slightly north along the Ruhr Valley, keeping over the Rhine, keeping north of the Ruhr as well as we could, which was a very heavily defended area, and then turning on down firstly to the Mona Dam. So we had the route maps which had been marked out, and we had the models. And so we spent, I suppose, probably discussing the models between ourselves and the route between ourselves. That's the pilots and the navigators, 2 or 3 hours there in the morning. Then we were sent back and still sworn to secrecy, and then the full briefing took place in the afternoon, the late afternoon, when all the crews came in and we saw the whole thing. They saw for the first time what the target was, and then there was a full briefing given by Gibson and by the station commander and by the group intelligence. We had Barnes Wallace there, who explained in detail the object of this particular operation. How the bombs would work, everybody was told how they would work, why we'd had to do all this practice, how we'd had to wait for this time, because the object was to hit these dams and breach them when they were absolutely full of water, up to their maximum capacity to do the most possible damage that we could. And of course, unbeknownst to us, reconnaissance aircraft had been flying over the dams for the previous 2 months, watching them as the water crept up. And of course, we had to wait for the full moon period, because the only way we could operate this was on the low flying was on the full moon period. And that period hit us in mid-May. Having had the briefing, of course, we were all then adjourned back to the mess, and had our pre-operational meal, and then waited for the takeoff, and went out and took off. If I turn to my logbook, I think takeoff, if I recall, was at takeoff was planned for the first wave of aircraft, which was 9 aircraft led by Gibson, 3 Vics of 3, was at 21:30, aiming to be over the target at around about midnight to breach them. And the sequence was that that set of 9 aircraft would take off and fly on this route, which, as I say, the Mona Dam was the first target near Soest, about 25 miles east of the Ruhr district. And this dam served all of the Ruhr industries. Its capacity, I think, was about 134 million tons of water. We would then attack that dam, and one aircraft at a time, starting with Gibson, and then once that one was breached, the aircraft would fly on to the Ada Dam, which was another 70-odd miles further east, and the Ada Dam was really serving all the hydroelectric systems for Castle and heavy industry areas through there. And then if there were anything left, to go on to the Sorpy Dam. Going back a little bit, at the same time that the 9 aircraft took off, immediately after that, flying on a slightly different route, 5 aircraft took off for the Sorpy Dam, so that there was to be an attack concurrently on the Sorpy and on the Mona at the same time. So that got the 14 aircraft off that stage, and then there were another 5 aircraft held in reserve, which were held back to be sent off to other dams, because there were other dams as well, of which we didn't have models at the briefing, but photographs were there. If we were successful with those 3 dams, well, then they would make further attacks the same night on other dams. So, but they were to be held back until such time as they had information back. So they were going to be a very late takeoff, about 1 in the morning, after the results had been radioed back of the success or otherwise of the breaching of the Mona and the Ada dams.
Can you tell me what happened next after takeoff, step by step?
Well, we took off, as I say, about 9:30. We formed up into our 3 Vics of 3 and flew across the North Sea, quite uneventful, until we hit the coast of Holland, and then the light flak the whole way along opened up from there, right through the Zuider Zee and the islands off to Schelling, and through the Dutch coast, were all very heavily defended at that time. And there was quite a lot of light flak there. We got through there, and then the main hazards going through were light flak, because whereas the information we'd had of the placements of the light flak across the route were not entirely right, we did go through one of the new aerodromes that had been put in there by the Germans in Germany, which was very heavily defended. And I think it was there that the first aircraft was shot down, that we saw shot down there. Bill Astolatoon turned out to be in the end of the day. It was the light flak and the searchlights, but flying at that level, although we would, searchlights would come up. Of course, we were too low for them to catch us in the beams and hold us there for any length of time. But recollection of on the route in is of the tracer that one could see from the light flak and the searchlights waving. I believe there were plenty of fighter aircraft about, but of course we were down on the deck, and the fighter aircraft didn't really know whether we were enemy or their own. And of course it's too low a level for the fighters to operate, to come down there. So there was no attacks made by the fighter aircraft. Once we got into the dams, silhouetted there in the moonlight, we could see them. Gibson said that he would do a reconnoitre, and we were all told to hold off back in the hills, 3 or 4 miles back from the dam itself, and to await the result. He made his attack through, and it was then that we found out that the Mona Dam was very heavily defended with light flak, quite a lot of light flak guns, A, on the dam wall itself, and B, on the sides on the approach to the dam. So there was quite a bit of light flak there. Gibson went through and released his mine, and there was a tremendous explosion of water and debris up into the air. But of course, when it waited to see it all subsided, the dam wall was still there. Hopwood, who was Gibson's number 2 at the time, I think had been hit by light flak on the way in, and he did his run in, and he got hit in the petrol tanks, and one wing caught fire as he was doing, and I think the bomb aimer was possibly hurt too, because his bomb bounced over